This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. We are delighted to have one of my favorite guests talking about one of the saddest but most critical issues, and that is really the issues of poverty and the issue of public benefits. What has become of our safety net? In essence, we're looking at gender, race, and poverty in America, how the politics of welfare makes us sick and tired of being sick and tired. And whenever I say that, I think of Fannie Lou Hamer. Because whatever Fannie Lou Hamer was talking about soon became an impassioned plea for a change in the system that exploited the Delta's African Americans. Quote, "All my life I've been sick and tired." She shakes her head. "Now I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." Fannie Lou Hamer, 1917 to 1977, who stood tall against the brutality, the indignities, the crushing poverty and intimidation of implacable racism, and economic deprivation in the extreme. Our guest tonight is Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont, and her new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective, couples with her earlier work, The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics, and Poverty in Modern America. It's so good to have you back. Well, I want to start with, and I speak really as a practitioner, the issue of a feminist kind of consideration of poverty. Now, the people who are overarchingly poor in this country are women and children. Women and children. That's and right. That is, of course, intersected with women and children, gender and race, overarchingly. And yet, we've had very little discourse amongst the progressive communities, amongst the women's community, about women and children who are poor, who have existed to whatever extent they can on public assistance. And at this point, in case people don't know, the public assistance benefits are from 2 to 5 years, and then they run out. So to what extent did that reality inform the writing of this book?
This is exactly what the book is about. We call it a feminist perspective because we want to speak to two main audiences. One is people who are involved in public policy, making it and analyzing it, who don't seem to see the obvious gendered dimensions, to see what's going on for women in particular, and also for men as gendered people, people who have specific expectations placed on them because they're men. So that's our first audience that we're thinking of, is public policy people who don't have any of that gender lens. But then on the other hand, we also want to talk to people who do have a gender lens, advocates, activists, even some of our colleagues in the university who have some of that feminist analysis but who are not bringing it to bear on our public policies, especially not our public policies having to do with poor people. And a lot of people have made a critique of the Me Too movement, for example, that we need to go beyond Hollywood and we need to look at working class women. My co-author and I are very much on board with that, but we would also say we're not just talking about people who are in the labor market, but people who are outside the labor market, people who are doing caregiving for their kids, for their elders, for disabled relatives, etc., and that has to be a serious dimension of any feminist conversation.
I just want to bring up, since we mentioned, or I certainly did, intersectionality, and you also dovetailed with which is primary, gender or race. Both. They meld together. But one of the things that I always thought was interesting, and I should say this because you live in the state of Vermont, in many ways, since the Welfare Reform and I call it Deconstruction Act that was passed by, yes, a Republican Congress, but the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton, yes, the Democrats, in 1996, there were states that had ties to white or a greater white population. Yes, they had very often, like Vermont, more progressive policies, but I want to give some sense that it made a difference about the way benefits were distributed, etc., based on the racial composition of various states. And I wonder if your research and so on has confirmed that as well.
I guess I would answer in three ways. But the first is that, yes, what I would call racist stereotypes and assumptions were built into this major welfare reform law that was passed in 1996 by the Republican Congress and signed by President Clinton, right? There's no question. And so in the book, my co-author and I talk about racialized gender. Talking about gender, we're talking about women in particular and also about men as gendered people, but it's always simultaneous with race. It's always, always there. So that's one piece. So the whole law was structured by race and racism. But then what some good research has indicated is that if you look at how it was implemented, there are differences based on whether the community has a higher or lower concentration of non-white people. It could be sort of subtle, even like whether certain local welfare department has privatized some of the services that are given to poor people, and then those privatized services tend to be stingier and less forgiving. You know, they tend to generate a lot of fake dismissals of people from the roles or false dismissals of people from the roles. And also people tend to be what they call sanctioned more often if they're in non-white communities, meaning people can be dropped from the rolls if they don't follow the rules, what they call full family sanctions, where the whole family will lose any access to public benefits if the adult who's receiving benefits is thought to have broken some rules, right? So there's a pretty clear pattern that some researchers I know have found that in places that are more non-white, the most unforgiving policies have been implemented. So we know that. And then we can look at a bigger level, state by state, and a state like mine, which is a very white state, is still reaching a pretty high percentage of poor people with public assistance benefits. And there are a lot of other states where the percentages are much, much lower. You could see race definitely is related to that. I think in a state like Vermont, there's more of a sense that's probably racially based that we have a common community and that we're, you know, looking out for each other. And there are plenty of differences between people, and there's plenty of nastiness and, sure, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that the assumption of a common culture, which goes along with whiteness, probably does have an effect on that. Yeah, I think you're probably quite right.
And I always thought that, of course, one of the reasons that Clinton could get away with doing this in 96 had nothing to do with the fact that there was a Republican Congress and that his reelection campaign was in jeopardy. It wasn't, it wasn't, it wasn't. But when you talk about benefits for a 2 to 5 year period, of course, what happens in states like New York and so on is there are states that have general assistance programs. The states that don't are overarchingly in the South. So that's where your population of people of color are going to be most sorely impacted. So we got broad swaths of people who are living now on just food stamps and Medicaid, and that's it. And they could get away with it because, in fact, it really was the southern states, as I said, for people who don't know much about the actuality of public assistance benefits, places like New York are supplemented by the general assistance programs that come from within the state and city itself. So that to me also seemed to be a callous disregard to begin with in 96 of the southern impoverished Delta black going back to really Fannie Lou Hamer's concerns. And I wonder if you take it to that point where there was that complete disregard of poor black women in the way that this was done, knowing full well that there are those states that have nothing to buttress their cutting off any form of benefits.
Yeah, I think in the middle 90s, I don't want to play devil's advocate too much, but I will say that from what I've read, the folks inside the Clinton administration who were pushing this policy, and it wasn't everyone, right? We should remember that there was enormous difference of opinion, even inside the Clinton White House.
Yeah,
and
Peter Edelman resigned. I mean, there were people who actually resigned, yeah.
Exactly, many people resigned. But the people who were pushing for it, and I think the president himself, they did think that they were going to be able to provide people with something. They thought that they were going to pass a major health care reform, for one thing. And even though they handled that very ineptly and in a way that was really top-down politically and alienated a lot of folks, they seemed to have believed that they were going to provide health care to everybody. So even though folks would not be getting this cash assistance because of the law that they were passing, that people wouldn't be so bad off because at least health care would be handled. And I think they also believed that they would be able, and this it's very naive, but I think they believed, or they convinced themselves, that they would be able to revisit it again, and that they would be able to, like, put more money into child care so that at least when people were pushed off of the welfare rolls into the labor market, there would be some decent care for their kids. They may have believed that they would be able to get some more money and support for education and training. So I think they believed that they were making a kind of a bargain, right? Not just that they were going to be pushing people off and impoverishing them, but that they were going to be doing that with one hand and then giving something back with the other hand. It never occurred. They never really got to revisit it, and they probably should have known that at the very least they couldn't count on those other things. But I think that was kind of the idea. And meanwhile, they thought, you know, Bill Clinton could preserve his own electoral career and make sure that he got reelected in 1996 and that they would save the reputation of the Democratic Party. Now, I think it was a total devil's bargain, but I do think that they were trying to enact some kind of bargain along those lines. And, you know, the piece about it that I think you're totally right about is that it was only thinkable for them to even do that because they didn't really think about the consequences for the low-income black women, especially in the South, who are going to be experiencing the consequences of this change.
Felicia, I'm really glad that you wrote this book because we talk so little about poverty in this country. We talk about wage stagnation. It hardly comes up in the campaigns. We talk about poverty. And very few people talk about welfare. It's like a dirty word nobody wants to talk about. Why is that? Why do you think there's such a dearth of exploration of this very important topic? And how is your book being received?
The book's being received really well. I think this is exactly our motivation, that the whole idea of poverty and welfare has dropped out of mainstream political conversation, mainstream media, and that's not because it's unimportant. And in fact, sort of like a present absence, it's like it's very much in our political discourse, even though we don't name it and we don't talk about it. Like when the Trump White House and the Congress try and add work requirements for the Medicaid program.
Right.
Well, they're just drawing on the welfare reform playbook from the 1990s. You know, and when they talk about cutting all the domestic social programs, including benefits for disabled people and older people, they just pull out the old rhetoric from the 90s. And it's effective because it hits those same notes. You know, it carries with it that same kind of sexism and racism that was driving the debate in the 90s. And yet nobody identifies it that way. Nobody says, hey, wait a minute, that policy from the 90s actually didn't work out. You know, that policy from the 90s really needs to be repudiated. But since it hasn't been repudiated, and, you know, nobody's really talking about it anymore, I think it's possible for these really, really bad Republicans that we have in Washington now to just pull it out and try and play it again. In fact, we should know that when they talk about work requirements, they're not going to help people get decent jobs. They're just using that as a ruse to cut people off of the Medicaid roll so that state governments can save a little bit of money. And we know that people are going to have horrible health and probably die younger than they otherwise would die if they lose those benefits.
And I must
that's
say,
what we're trying to do. Yeah,
I think actually it is being spoken about a great deal. I think what's not happening is I think the left and progressives are not paying very much attention to these issues. But I think the politicians pay great attention to them, and I absolutely believe that the next rung of attack was most decidedly going to be within the Congress, which now at least, thank goodness, has some check on it by virtue of the House, although I still remember that it's Clinton who passed the 1996 devastation of welfare. But nevertheless, I hope that becomes the check of what the Republicans no doubt had intention to do, which is to further curve and carve away at various quote-unquote entitlements. And I must say that I think that one of the good things that Clinton did was that he did extend the whole issue of tax credits, the earned income tax credit. I think that was very good. I think it needs to be
that's the other thing, yep.
That needs to be extended. But what I think is quite remarkable and what we don't see is, so what you were talking about earlier, yeah, they were talking about education, right? They were talking about child care. They were talking about rent subsidies. Where has any of that gone? I would just say that, for example, in our office, we just had a case of a 12-person household where they spend upwards of $3,000 a month for child care. So the various issues that were philosophically brewing in 1996 about education, about things of that sort, what's happened to them? How none of them have been put into play and thus rendering people not only impoverished, but again, being pushed off a cliff when your benefits end, your benefits end. It's not even a gradualist program. So how do you think that was allowed to play out?
I think the Clinton Democrats didn't fight hard enough. They were more interested in their own electoral success than they were in making sure that things worked out okay for working class and poor Americans. I think that's absolutely true. One thing that was interesting that I found out in the research for this book was that same press conference where Bill Clinton was first confronted about his affair with Monica Lewinsky, they were going to announce a huge new child care initiative. And that never really happened. And Bill Clinton kind of lost any, you know, capacity he had to expand gendered policies when he was in the throes of the impeachment over his affair with Monica Lewinsky. So that's a kind of, you know, historical irony or something. Even after that time, the Democrats would say, you know, year after year when they were repassing the welfare legislation, they would say, oh, we have so many dollars in the child care fund. But it's just sophistry because it didn't matter that they were increasing the number of dollars. It was still so far from what people actually needed to afford child care. Right, child care is incredibly expensive. The cost of it increases every year because there's a cost of living increase. And there never was anything like an entitlement or a guarantee for women who were receiving welfare or for anybody else that they would actually have child care for their kids. So, I mean, that's an obvious thing that Democrats could take action on if they were really willing to do it, if they were really willing to go to the mat, not just for the poorest of the poor, but for all families, right? I don't know anybody who has an easy time paying for child care.
I'm interested in what you see percolating up from or is something that needs to be stimulated, because I will say that aside from the fact that so-called welfare reform, the educational training programs that they were talking about proved to be just lip service, nothing happened there. Trump's talking about advocating taking away birth control, and at the same time that we have a lower teenage pregnancy rate than ever before. I mean, the whole mythologies are exploding. But one of the things that hits me, of course, is things like the rent subsidies. That's what's eating up the most considerable amount of people's rents. Ironically, in New York, if you have a bigger family, you do better because you get a higher rent subsidy per person. It's actually the people that are suffering the most are the people with the smaller families, the 2- and 3-person household. So I'm interested in what you see as kind of a rekindled debate and return to really what are the demands to diminish this intensity of poverty. And I would certainly say absolutely and unequivocally, while I believe in building housing, certainly in the interim, at least having something equivalent to a Section 8 subsidy that is commensurate with the cost of housing would do a lot to alleviating the most dire realities of poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people are talking about how to intervene in the housing market. What we say in Ensuring Poverty, well, first we chronicle what happened in the past, right? And we want to remind people that there were serious debates about these issues and that there were alternative proposals that were brought to the fore by feminists like Representative Patsy Mink of Hawaii, who was the mother of my co-author, Gwendolyn Mink, a political scientist. Patsy Mink and others, especially women of color in the Democratic caucus in Washington, did offer an alternative in the early 2000s that would have turned welfare back into a system of family support, the way it had been before this welfare reform of 1996 and the way it was really intended to be when this program was created during the Depression. And also, I was part of a national network of feminist writers and activists called the Women's Committee of 100. And the Women's Committee of 100 created an even more searching alternative approach. And I think we could go back to that approach. It's an approach that focuses on caregiving. And it says, essentially, look, being in the labor market is great, but that is not all that we do or all that we are as people. We are also people who care for our children and our elders and for people in times of disability and disease. We need a system. We need an economic and a governmental system that accounts for that. This is work. The work of caregiving is done disproportionately by women, either for pay or not for pay. And, you know, as a society, we just need to come to terms with that reality. It's not like people are going to stop doing that caregiving work. It's just that they take on all kinds of harm when they do the caregiving work, right? So we need to put caregiving at the center, and we need to get over our very, very strange fetishization of paid work. Paid work is only one dimension of our lives, and we don't really need to have everybody doing paid work. You know, I think we need to ask ourselves what kind of society we want to have, what kind of families we want to have, you know, what kinds of relationships we want to have with each other. Do we all want to be, like, dying from stress? Do we all want to be working 2 jobs? Do we all want to be worrying every single day of our lives that we're not going to have enough money in old age and that we're going to be in some horrible nursing home or on the street or something? Like, I think we need to ask those kinds of questions because we've gotten very, very far away from, you know, a real understanding that we could use government to support the lives and the families that we actually want to have.
I think one of the most important things that your book does, and as I said, I couple it with the book that you wrote before that, and again, the book that we are referring to is Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective, is just that feminist perspective, applying a gender-based and race-based analysis to the area of entitlements and helping us by doing that understand what the problem was in 1996 and what the total women's movement, if you will, must encompass, because poverty is first and foremost, it is a women's issue. And I think your book takes us so far in understanding that. And, of course, the very specifics of what needs to be done with public transportation costs and housing costs and all these things that go into making people poor, making women poor, making women of color poor. And so in the final analysis, your sense about what the message is to, yes, practitioners, advocates, and women and people of goodwill about where to go and what we need to think about to revive a movement that really gets to the heart of perhaps restitching up, if nothing else, the failed safety net for poor women of color.
Well, I think of two things immediately. One is that we just have to return to this history and unpack it, and that's what I hope the book helps people do. And when we go back, we learn a lot about the really outsized racist and sexist origins of this particular public policy, and anti-immigrant too, by the way. And I think for anyone who identifies as a Democrat, even as a kind of a dissident Democrat or a Bernie Sanders occasional Democrat, progressive, I think it's worth it to go back and really think about what happened in the middle 1990s and how badly off course the Democratic Party in particular went, and how much the Democratic Party co-signed some of these really invidious stereotypes and assumptions. And we have to be able to go back and say, look, we screwed up, or they screwed up, our predecessors screwed up. I kind of think of this as the original sin of the modern Democratic Party. And if we don't get real about it and we don't fix it, then it's going to be really hard to move forward. And then the second thing, joined at the hip with that, is that we really have to look at the way we fetishize work, the thing we understand as work, you know, waged work. And a lot of progressive policies, even the earned income credit and other policies that attempt to help working class and poor people, are still so tied to this idea that it's all about work, 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 work for money, and that that's the only thing that matters, and that that's the only way that people can prove that they deserve to survive. And I think it'll be hard in the short run, but I think we have to be willing to just throw that assumption out the window.
And if
we don't do that, the Republicans are going to win.
And we've got everything we need. We've got all the ammunition, ideological and practical, in Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective by Felicia Kornbluh and the wonderful Gwendolyn Mink, who I hope will also come and join us next time. And there will be many more next times, because Ken and I are absolutely immersed and concerned about this issue. It is one of the foremost considerations that we have, and the ultimate, really, conjuncture of race and class here, and that is the enduring poverty and the issue of our society's responsibility to alleviate the most onerous symptoms of poverty until we have a complete redistribution of wealth. But I guess that'll be the next book.
Which I think you're working on now.
I wouldn't be surprised. Felicia Kornbluh, thank you so much for joining with us. We have to continue this discussion.
You bet. I'd love to come back.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.